This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, October 8th, 2012, Columbus Day. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. KUAF is supported by Circle of Life Hospice, offering compassionate end-of-life care for body, mind, spirit, and family. Off-site assistance, including freestanding inpatient homes, is available. Circle of Life Hospice, ask for us by name. NWACircleoflife.org for more information. Support for KUAF is also provided by the 7th Annual Cherokee Art Market, featuring 130 Native American artists, along with interactive cultural demonstrations October 13th and 14th inside the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tulsa. More information is available at CherokeeArtMarket.com. Ahead on this edition of the program, we take a look at the effects of gravel mining in the Ozarks. And the University of Arkansas has organized a month's worth of events that focus on disability awareness. Plus, we have the latest installment of Arkansongs. Becca Martin Brown stops by to tell us what's up in entertainment and more. But first, state officials say during the past decade, Arkansas has experienced high rates of domestic homicide compared to the rest of the nation. In a recent radio address, Governor Mike Beebe said there needs to be an increase in public awareness and outreach to victims of domestic abuse in order to combat the stigmas associated with domestic violence.
Many domestic violence victims do not seek help for physical abuse and emotional trauma because they believe they have nowhere to turn. Fortunately, there are at least 36 local domestic violence programs in our state, and in the past 5 years, those programs have supported about 22,000 Arkansas women.
October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and Beebe says the state must make sure those affected get the transportation, therapy, and security they need to ensure safety. The 67th Annual Turkey Trot Festival is taking place beginning Friday in Yellville, and an animal rights group wants to make sure it does not include tossing live turkeys from airplanes. Martin Mercereau is with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, which is offering a $5,000 reward for the arrest and conviction of anyone throwing turkeys from a plane. At that altitude and speed, he says the turkeys plummet to the ground.
Last year, it didn't happen because the Federal Aviation Administration was all over it. We got wind of some rumors that it may happen again this year. And you know, this is a tradition that's been going on for many years. So you know, I'm not sure it's going to stop all of a sudden. And there may be some people who are willing to risk their pilot's licenses and jail time to engage in this cruel activity.
Organizers say tossing live turkeys has not been a sanctioned part of the festival, which includes a parade, 5K run, pageant, and the nation's oldest wild turkey calling contest. Last week, schools in Northwest Arkansas received art supplies to help encourage the arts in education. As part of its Art Closet program, the Thea Foundation donated $15,000 worth of art supplies to 8 schools in the 4 largest districts in the area. Schools were chosen based on the percentage of students participating in free lunch programs. Paul Leopoulos is the executive director of the Thea Foundation. He says he believes education is suffering in some ways due to the trimming of art, drama, and music classes. As a consequence, he says the foundation aims to improve learning by introducing creativity into the broader curriculum.
What we try to provide with the Art Closet are those tools for teachers to use that allows them to really teach math in several ways, or science, or history, or reading. And so we know that art supplies are not a priority for many principals. Some they are, but many don't really understand the nuance of how those art supplies can be used in the school to generate excitement and interest in the curriculum.
The foundation's donation of school supplies was possible through a grant given to the Thea Foundation by the Willard and Pat Walker Charitable Foundation. But Leopoulos says that Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville provided another key component of getting the most out of the donated art supplies.
We asked them to write some curriculum around those art supplies. So they wrote some curriculum using their art at Crystal Bridges. These art supplies, again, to add the creative process into the teaching of history, American history. So I reached out to them, and they most graciously worked with us on that.
The Art Closet program is only one of the foundation's efforts to encourage students' creativity.
We also have a matching program on Donors Choose, where any teachers, not just art teachers, but any teacher in any classroom we will match up to a $250 grant to help them buy materials they need to add creativity into their classroom. We give 28 scholarships a year to high school seniors in visual arts and performing arts, in creative writing, in film, and in slam poetry. And the only reason we do that is to motivate those kids, like our daughter was when she had success in her creative classes, to motivate them to believe in themselves.
Leopoulos says he and his wife, Linda, created the foundation in memory of their late daughter, Thea K. Theopolis. He says that Thea's lack of confidence was transformed into a do-anything attitude after her involvement in arts-related activities during her junior year of high school. Residents in southern Washington County are moving closer to having a permanent potable water source. Last week, the Washington Water Authority turned on the tap for the first customers of Phase 2 of the County Rural Development Authority's water project, which, when completed, will serve about 300 households with clean, safe running water, an amenity that has never been present in that part of the county. County Judge Marilyn Edwards says the construction progress has been moving steadily along.
You know, we had a really, really good winter last year. We're hoping that we have equally as good so that they can continue. But it's a slow process because you're going across mountains, you're going across rock, and you're, you know, you've got every kind of element that you can imagine. But no, it's moving very, very well.
Edwards says the project should be completed sometime next year. A University of Arkansas team of researchers studying one of the oldest organisms on Earth recently received a sizable grant from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The three-year grant is worth more than $391,000 and is awarded from the NASA Exobiology Program. With the grant money, the team will study methanogens to see if the methane-producing organisms found in marshes and the stomachs of cows can survive under the harsh environmental conditions found on Mars. The data will be used to determine whether life can survive on the red planet. Late last week, Northwest Arkansas Community College in Bentonville announced that it is one step closer to selecting its next president. The college announced that its presidential search committee has narrowed the field from 30 applicants to 6 semifinalists. The list of those who made the cut include Joe Alice Blondin, the chancellor of Arkansas Tech University in Ozark, and Stephen Gates, the vice president for learning at Northwest Arkansas Community College, as well as candidates from Moberly and St. Louis, Missouri, Wichita, Kansas, and from Arizona. The candidate that the NWAC committee selects will become only the third president in the college's 22-year history. Two government websites in the area recently received good grades from a national advocacy group that monitors government transparency. The nonprofit Sunshine Review gave websites for both the cities of Fayetteville and Fort Smith a B grade for their online transparency efforts. The review ranks several transparency areas for each website, including how much information is given about budgets, meetings, elected and administration officials, permits, zoning audits, public records, and taxes, all areas in which the Fayetteville and Fort Smith sites passed with flying colors. Areas in which both sites were lacking included information about lobbying and government contracts. The Sunshine Review rated 5 government websites in the state, the only other one in the area being the site for Springdale City Government, which received a grade of C-. Today being Columbus Day, government offices in the area are closed for the federal holiday, but if you haven't yet registered to vote, you still have time. According to Arkansas Secretary of State Mark Martin, the deadline to register for the general election is tomorrow, except in Sebastian County, where today is the deadline. Registration can be completed at your local county clerk's office. The Razorback soccer team was at home at Razorback Field this weekend. On Friday, the team suffered a 3-2 loss to Vanderbilt in the second overtime of the match. However, the Razorbacks made up for it on Sunday when they defeated Alabama 3-1. The defeat of Alabama is the team's first since 2006. After the weekend, the team has 3 wins, 4 losses, and 1 tie in Southeastern Conference play and a 6-7-1 record overall. The Razorbacks will play their final home games next weekend as they host Texas A&M on Friday and Auburn on Sunday. In volleyball action, the Razorback volleyball team lost Friday evening on the road against 11th-ranked Florida. With the straight set loss, the Razorbacks dropped to 13-4 overall and 4-2 in conference play. The team will next play Sunday in Oxford, Mississippi as the Razorbacks face Ole Miss. The UA swimming and diving team hosted the inaugural Razorback Relays on Saturday. The team took first place over Vanderbilt, North Texas, SMU, and Missouri State. The Razorbacks finished with 9 event wins out of 12 in the meet. The team will return to the pool on October 19th when they face Georgia. And in tennis action, the Arkansas women's tennis team competed in the Razorback Classic over the weekend. On Friday, the team won all four of its singles matches against members of teams from Tulsa, Missouri, and Houston. And the team also netted a doubles win against a duo from Houston. The Razorbacks returned to the courts for the ITA Central Regional on October 19th in Tulsa. Tonight's weather forecast calls for clear conditions with a low of 39 degrees in northwest Arkansas and a low of 45 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a high near 68 degrees in northwest Arkansas and a high of 73 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow night, expect partly cloudy conditions with a low in northwest Arkansas of 43 degrees and a low of 52 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. Healthy rivers, streams, and creeks require a delicate balance of water, minerals, creatures, and vegetation. Take gravel, found in many Ozark Highland streams, which clarifies and oxygenates water. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, if you literally take gravel out of a stream, that exquisite natural balance may be disrupted.
We're walking in Keels Creek, a pretty little spring-fed tributary of the Kings River in South Carroll County. The creek, which has been mostly dry this summer due to drought, contains lots of gravel and occasional deep pools of brown, murky water. The creek's deteriorating condition worries a number of landholders who live along it.
So my name is Chris Fisher, and I'm a property owner along Keels Creek, where Little Winona Creek joins the water body known as Keels. And we're about two air miles, as the crow would fly, from the Kings River. And so one day when I was watching the creek, when there was a substantial amount of water in it already from storms, there was this plume of orangey-red sort of pasta sauce color effluent going by, and I thought, where is that coming from? And within a few seconds, I could hear either a tractor or a bulldozer or a backhoe chugging away somewhere upstream.
Turns out several neighbors to the west have been removing creek gravel for years, dislodging plumes of sediment. One of them is Matthew Martin, operator of R&R Dirtworks. He declined being interviewed on tape for this story, but in a telephone conversation, he said he began to harvest gravel 5 years ago, at first for personal use on his land, which is legal, but then record rains in recent years have pushed huge piles of stone downstream onto his place, which he's been removing and selling, he said, since 2009, for around $10 a ton without a permit. He's been cited several times by state environmental agents and fined. But he says he's doing the watershed a service by preventing more gravel clogs further downstream. Matthew Martin is now in process of applying for a permit, despite being under a state environmental order to stop. Keels Creek empties into the Kings River 2 miles east of here, designated as an extraordinary resource waterway, a popular floating stream. No mining's allowed on the Kings. But because gravel-rich tributaries like Keels are up for grabs, the water surges through much quicker now, scouring the banks, dislodging sediment and debris, choking aquatic life. University of Arkansas ecology professor Dr. Arthur Brown has studied the impacts of gravel mining on Ozark streams for years. He said gravel and undisturbed streams create riffles, shallow flows, and intermittent shallow pools to prevent erosion and promote oxygenation.
See, a gravel riffle acts like a filter, and there's a lot of the water passes through it, not just over the top of it. And so organic material is captured there along with other things, and invertebrates like it, so they really are more productive in riffle areas, and so The fish have more to eat and streams that have more riffles.
Kind of natural law, scientists figured out. Riffles occur at intervals 5 to 7 times the width of the stream. Professor Brown says a gravel stream will also struggle to adjust itself if intensely disturbed.
The stream has to rearrange all that gravel for kilometers upstream and downstream from the site where the gravel's been mined.
Which would account for huge surges of gravel being washed through Keels Creek in recent years, so bad that a Carroll Boone Water District pipeline buried adjacent to the creek almost washed out, imperiling the drinking water supply for tens of thousands of residents. Professor Arthur Brown has also studied gravel removal from the Kings River back in the 90s, before mining was banned.
The miners were allowed a 2-year moratorium on the law when it came into effect. And so they got in and just took out all the gravel they could, stockpiled it on the hillside out there. And so the Kings is really starved for gravel. It has a whole lot of bedrock, and if you go in and try to sample invertebrates on bedrock, they are very rare.
Which is why scientists like Dr. Brown recommend prohibiting all in-stream gravel mining and allowing nature to take its course. Historically, most gravel substrate streams in Arkansas have been chronically mined, primarily for road aggregate, causing extensive disruption of habitat. That's according to the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, which oversees gravel mining in the state. But ADEQ spokesperson Catherine Beninati says the law continues to evolve.
We've regulated mining since the 1970s. In 1971, the Arkansas Open Cut Land Reclamation Act was created. And at the time, it included coal mining. That was separated out later in the 1970s because that was included in a federal law. And the a major rewrite of that law was done in the early 90s, in 1991. And that was when we developed Regulation 15, which you know lays out all the rules for mining in the state. And in 95 is when in-stream mining was allowed.
ADEQ currently permits 258 open-cut gravel and sand mines on the land. In 2005, we had 13 in-stream commercial operations. Today, only 4 are permitted: on Osage Creek in Carroll County, operated by the Carroll County Road Department; on Houston Hollow in Madison County, by its road department; Mountain View Ready Mix harvests gravel out of South Sillmore Creek in Stone County; and one other mine operation on Wolf Creek in Pike County. Streams are categorized according to aquatic health and recreational use by ADEQ. No mining is allowed on extraordinary resource waterways like the Kings and the Buffalo. And then we have places like Crooked Creek in Boone County, which was almost gravel mined to death. Steve Filipek is assistant chief in the Fisheries Division of the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission.
On Crooked Creek, at one time, there it's about an 87-mile-long stream, one of the best smallmouth streams in the nation, much less in the central part of the country, and much less in Arkansas. So anyway, it's a very good stream, high water quality at the time. Well, because of gravel mining, there were at one time 45 either active or recently inactive gravel mines on an 87-mile-long stream. So you kind of get the magnitude of the issue here. Every other mile, just about on average, of course, there was a gravel mine.
Since 2005, in-stream mining started to slowly decline along Crooked Creek. It's remained impaired but is recovering, Filipek says. In his 35-year-long career with Arkansas Game and Fish Commission working on streams, Filipek says he's seen gravel mining on most of the state's interior highland waterways. But he says thanks to oversight, first by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and later ADEQ's Regulation 15, stream health continues to improve on the Ozarks.
So a stream is so dynamic, once you start messing with the stability of the bed load and all that, it's going to start having impacts upstream and sedimentation downstream. So that's why we have to be so cognizant of the best management practices that we need to use for gravel mining, and that's why, generally speaking, aquatic biologists, fishery biologists would say, get the gravel from a quarry, crush it, get it from a quarry. That would be our number one recommendation. Number two, get it from the floodplain far enough away from the stream that you're not going to be doing damage to the stream itself. And I'm not even going to say recommendation number three is get it from the channel itself, because we don't recommend that.
But until all in-stream gravel mining ceases, ADEQ Surface Mining and Reclamation Division, with a staff of 14, has only one inspector assigned to non-coal surface mining for the entire state. A good portion of inspections are driven by citizen complaints. So with two summers of drought laying creek gravel bare for the taking, has gravel removal increased? Once again, ADEQ spokesperson Catherine Beninati.
We haven't noticed any difference this summer. Mining is cyclical. It's tied to the construction industry, and they're more active in the summer. So we haven't noticed any change in the trends. But we've had 186 complaints that we've followed up on since 2003.
Citizen complaints are what drove ADEQ to investigate R&R Dirtworks' illegal in-stream gravel mining operation on Keels Creek 5 times in 5 years. And over the past 10 years, more than 5 in-stream operators were fined a total of $10,000. 6 gravel processing facilities were also cited $40,000 collectively, primarily for unpermitted discharges in places like Madison, Carroll, Van Buren, and Ouachita counties. On ADEQ's webpage, under the legal orders database, the surface mining section lists nearly 60 consent administrative orders issued over the past decade.
Consent administrative order is different, and essentially that is an agreement that we work together with the person who enters into it with us to figure out what action can be taken to correct the problem, a timeline for that corrective action, and any kind of fines that would be related to that.
The Nature Conservancy, which owns lots of property along the Kings, is planting riparian vegetation to repair scoured stream banks, as is the nonprofit Kings River Watershed Partnership. That group also provides a free online handbook titled The Landowner's Guide to Streamside Living. Gravel comes in all sorts of grades, from crushed limestone to rounded quartz. The gravel found in Keels Creek is a mix of luminous white, gray, and pink dolomite limestone and flint. When washed and screened, could be sold as decorative Arkansas pebbles, fetching as much as $110 per ton. But stricter enforcement, and most especially persistent complaints by concerned citizens, will help to maintain Keels Creek beautiful and ecological critical gravel array. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. September net revenues climbed higher for the state thanks to strong individual income tax collections, while sales and use taxes struggled for the second consecutive month. Corporate income taxes were also lower in September. September was expected to see a boost in sales tax collections as the month's report would reflect the state's new back-to-school sales tax holiday activity. However, for the month, September sales and use tax collections totaled $178 million. That's a decrease of over $1 million, or 0.7% from last year. Collections were below monthly forecast levels, too, by 3.9%. August jobless rates in Arkansas's major metropolitan areas declined from the previous month and in year-over-year comparisons. According to figures released Wednesday by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, all of the 8 metropolitan areas in or connected to Arkansas had jobless rate declines in August compared to July, and they were all down compared to August of 1 year ago. The Arkansas Supreme Court disqualified a proposed constitutional amendment to allow casino operations throughout the state. It was a measure being guided by professional poker player Nancy Todd. The proposal would have allowed casinos in Crittenden, Franklin, Miller, and Pulaski counties. The state's high court determined that Todd's change to the ballot title after signatures were gathered was improper. Bank of the Ozarks will acquire Janella Bank of Alabama for $27.3 million, the two banks announced on Thursday. According to the terms of the agreement, Bank of the Ozarks will acquire all of the outstanding common stock of the bank in Alabama. A transaction is expected to close in late December 2012 or during the first quarter of 2013. Arkansas received an overall grade of C for its online transparency, according to a nonprofit group that studies the issue. In a report released Wednesday, Alexandria, Virginia-based Sunshine Review gave Arkansas an overall grade of C. broken down by category, it gave the state government a B, counties a D minus, cities a C, and school districts a C. The report was released about 3 months after the debut of the state's online checkbook, a searchable website documenting state expenditures. Lieutenant Governor Mark Darr, who led the push for the website, noted that earlier this year, before the online checkbook launched, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group gave Arkansas an F for online transparency. And finally, Governor Mike Beebe told healthcare and hospital leaders that expansion of the state's Medicaid program would be helpful to their cause, and he suggested that economics, not politics, should drive the decision to grow the state program. Beebe was speaking at the annual meeting of the Arkansas Hospital Association, where he encouraged participants to explain the importance of Medicaid to local legislators. Got a bunch of people running around here now beating their chests politically that need to keep their mouth shut, get the facts, and then vote their conscience on what is in the best interest of their constituents and their people, Beebe told the crowd. That did not sit well with Republican legislators. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, the University of Arkansas kicked off its inaugural Disability Awareness Month. The event is an expansion of the university's Disability Awareness Week. The effort to create the week-long event was initiated by senior George Turner.
My first semester here was a huge, huge snowstorm. And it was the second that they had had. The first one came the year before, and it knocked out their power. And they were completely unprepared for it. Not really something you can prepare for. And whenever I got here, I had to get in my dorm, and I had to literally leave my chair in the trunk because we couldn't get through the ice. And so I was basically stuck in my dorm for the first week that I was in school because they didn't pave the sidewalks. Now, of course, they didn't know I was there, so they didn't bother to clean the ramps and stuff because they just didn't know there was a need for it. And so I contacted some people. My father sent an email to the chancellor's office, and they cleared it up. And through that process, I realized that there's a lot of people at this university that really do care about disabilities and the needs of those students, but they don't have the resources they need to find out what those needs are and the resources to take care of those needs. And so I created Disabilities Awareness Week as a means to involve students and also outside organizations in helping create solutions to those needs.
George is a full-time student and also works about 36 hours a week for the university's Office of Development. With such a busy schedule, the 26-year-old communications major is working in more of an advisory capacity for this year's event. George explains expanding the event to a month gives organizers more flexibility to work with other organizations.
Actually, October is it's National Disability Employment Month, and also it's National Physical Therapy Month, and it also happens to be Spina Bifida Awareness Month, which is what I was born with. And we just wanted to be able to give other organizations an opportunity to really get involved with what we're doing.
Sources for Community Independent Living Services, the Volunteer Action Center, and the Department of University Recreation are among the groups sponsoring events throughout October. Tonight, Disability Awareness Month continues with an inclusive obstacle course at the Hyper Building on the U of A campus.
It's an opportunity for students with and without disabilities to experience some of the recreational activities that are over at the Hyper Building. On campus, and really just have a good time and hang out with other friends. And I think there might be opportunity for regular students to experience some of the things that students with disabilities actually play with.
A 3-mile ability roll and walk run is scheduled for 5:00 Thursday at Wilson Park in Fayetteville. The event is free, and wheelchairs, bikes, and strollers are all welcome. Fleet Feet Sports will provide timing for interested participants, and the first 100 people to register will receive a free t-shirt. On October 17th, the Arkansas Union on the U of A campus will be the site of a disability symposium. The keynote speaker at the luncheon will be Neil Romano, the former Assistant Secretary of Labor for Disability Employment Policy and head of the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Disability Employment Policy. The symposium will feature a speaker from the National Organization on Disability as well. George says the symposium will provide a way to educate the community on the topic of disabilities.
We want to move people past the idea of thinking of accessibility as codes or rules, and we really want to get them to think about it in terms of inclusion. You know, I always look at it in terms of the three things: accessibility, independence, and inclusion. And if you think of it in terms of those three things, whenever you build a door or you host an event, I think those cover really the core values that we really try to get across whenever we try to teach people about accessibility. Because you want people to, you don't just want to give somebody a space in the room, you want them to be able to interact and experience that event, that service, like everybody else does.
On October 20th, participants will spend the day building accessibility ramps for local residents. Disability Awareness Month will wrap up October 25th with a Disability Community Resource Fair and art exhibit at the International Connections Lounge inside the Arkansas Union on the U of A campus. The resource fair will feature informational booths promoting community resources and information dedicated to inclusion and community participation, while the art exhibit will feature artwork from participants in Lifestyles Incorporated's College for Living art program. Participating in any of these events will give people the opportunity to learn more about disabilities.
It is something that you generally have to experience. And so it really helps to interact with people with disabilities and ask some questions. Don't be shy. Don't be afraid. Because it's nothing to be worried about, or you don't want to feel like you're going to offend somebody, because you're not. You're learning, and they understand that.
Although Disability Awareness Month is being organized by the U of A, George says the events are open to anyone in the community. For volunteering information, visit volunteer.uark.edu. For more information on any or all of the events, visit cea.uark.edu. It's Monday, October 8th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Is this a good time for our How Can It Be the 8th of October?
I think this is a fantastic time because Kyle's in here to roll his eyes at us.
How can it be the 8th of October?
I don't know.
Okay. But there's good things going on.
Okay.
There's an architecture lecture tonight with Mark Nelson talking about constructing critical engagement at 5:30 in the Hembry Auditorium at Agriculture, Food, and Life Sciences Building on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville. And tonight at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center in Fort Smith, part of their season of entertainment. You might have seen him at the Walton Arts Center. And if you're longing for more, the Midtown Men perform at 7:30 tonight. Original cast from Jersey Boys, and they will be on stage again at 7:30. Tickets start at $32 at 788-7300.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Hey, Pedro, where is Lolito?
Among his many musical innovations, R&B pioneer Louis Jordan of Brinkley helped introduce calypso music to North America, and his 1947 song Early in the Morning was the Arkansas' first to pay homage to the island-based musical genre.
Early in the morning and I can't get right. Had a little date with my baby last night. Now it's early in the morning. Early in the morning. Early in the morning and I ain't got nothing but the blues.
Recorded in April 1947, the Rumba Blues features the Calypso Boys guesting on percussion. Several esteemed members of Louis Jordan's Timpani Five play on the track, like trumpeter Aaron Eisenhall, pianist Wild Bill Davis, and drummer Joe Chris Columbus Morris. Chuck Berry-influenced Carl Hogan of St. Louis plays electric guitar, while Cave Spring, Missouri-born bassist Dallas Bartley gets co-writing credit, along with Louis Jordan and Leo Hickman. Early in the Morning was originally released in October 1947 as a 78 single, with Lookout as the B-side.
Hey, lady, you mean to take up Spanish, but I ain't. Hey, Pedro,
Monroe County native Louis Jordan returned to other Afro-Cuban styled songs and continued performing early in the morning, including featuring it in his 1949 Western themed movie, Lookout Sister. Early in the Morning was a well-regarded enough hit from Louis Jordan's back catalog that it was among the first on the list when the Arkansasian re-recorded his biggest songs a decade later for a new label, Mercury, on the new long-playing album format in 1956 and 1958, heard here.
And I can't get right. Had a little date with my baby last night. Now it's early in the morning. Ooh, in the morning. Early in the morning, and I ain't got nothing but the blues. I went through all the places where we used to go. I went to her house, but she don't live there no more. Now it's early in the morning.
Calypso music had caught on by then in the United States. In fact, even Lafayette County native Maya Angelou recorded a Calypso-themed album during this time, along with Harry Belafonte and the rest.
Early in the morning, I can't do right. Had a little fight with my baby last night, and it's early in the morning. Don't you know it's early in the morning? Early in the morning, I ain't got nothing, no nothing but the blues.
Early in the Morning had its own life with a song beyond Louis Jordan, the Timpani Five, as well. The song appears in Five Guys Named Mo, the 1990s musical about Louis Jordan. It's heard on Ray Charles' 1961 album, Genius Sings the Blues, one of many Louis Jordan songs Ray Charles recorded. Joe Cocker, Buddy Guy, Gapemouth Brown, Irma Thomas, and B.B. King have all covered it, the latter on his 1999 Louis Jordan tribute album. In the early 1970s, even songwriter Harry Nilsson recorded this version.
I went to Doobie Chase to get something to eat. The waitress looked at me, she said, Harry, you sure look beat. I said it's early in the morning. Don't you know it's early in the morning? Early in the morning.
The popularity of Early in the Morning has continued. Little Rock native Jim Dickinson included it among three Louis Jordan songs on his 2009 album, Dinosaurs Run in Circles. In 2010, Early in the Morning appeared on Cyndi Lauper's Memphis Blues album, recorded with Alan Toussaint, and the musical legacy of Monroe County's Louis Jordan stretches on. Here in its entirety is Arkansasian Louis Jordan of Brinkley's Early in the Morning, as sung by Cyndi Lauper on her 2010 album, Memphis Blues, recorded with Alan Toussaint.
Thank you. chase to get something to eat. Waitress looked at me, said, "Ma, you look beat. Now it's early in the morning.
Early in the morning,
ooh,
baby.
In the morning.
Early in the morning.
Yeah, it's early in the morning, and I ain't got nothing but the blues.
All right.
Yeah, I had a lot of money when I started out.
Cyndi Lauper from her 2010 album Memphis Blues with Alan Toussaint singing Arkansas-er Louis Jordan of Brinkley's Early in the Morning. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
This is Ozarks at Large. For those of us lucky enough to have spent some time with our grandparents as children, we probably have several fond memories of them. For some, it might be their grandmother baking her special apple pie each Thanksgiving, or perhaps the first time their grandfather took them fishing. For Ozarks at Large's Meredith Martin Motes, one of the most vivid memories she has is of her grandmother performing an everyday household chore.
My grandmother, short, chubby, and silver-haired, would open the hall closet and reach into the worn-out cloth sack hanging over the door, pulling out handfuls of clothespins and shoving them into the front pockets of her apron. With a plastic green laundry basket on her hip, she walked down the back steps to the clothesline, hanging out my grandfather's overalls and her polyester shirts and handmade house slippers on the line to dry. As she bent down to pick up the clothes and reached up to pin them on the line, her movements appeared rhythmic and hypnotic. Argyles and stripes, faded pinstripe denim, and purple and green plaid flannels all whipped back and forth in the breeze, shaking out the water and fading the fabrics in the sun. Her name was Golda Faye Taylor McRoy, and she died decades ago, just as I was becoming a teenager. Despite the years, the memory of her standing among drying fabrics remains forever vivid. I especially love those days she washed sheets. Hanging nearly to the ground and ruffling the grass, I would run underneath them, pretending I was in a fort, a castle, hiding in a tent, secure in a warm igloo, or any other faraway abode I knew virtually nothing about. As cliché as it may sound now, and as mundane as such tasks must have felt to her then, there was something magical about the pop and whish of the sheets in the wind, and the myriad of hideouts they offered my six-year-old self. On those evenings when I spent the night at her house, I'd fall asleep to the smell of the breeze buried deep into the fibers of the bedding. My grandmother and grandfather lived on a main street in a small town in Yell County within walking distance of the Arkansas River. For reasons both cultural and financial, they lived a life with fewer barriers to the natural world. Their windows were always open. A small patch of yard-grown tomatoes, peppers, and endless pecans supplemented their diet, and they possessed very little sense of dependency on technology to make it through their days. I don't want to over-romanticize my grandmother's life, her tiny house, or her dirty laundry. I'm sure she would have loved to occasionally skip that trip to the clothesline and shove those wet clothes in an electric dryer especially on those rainy days when she either had to skip laundry altogether or hang the clothes around the house and risk them becoming dank with a mildewy smell. And I suspect she got really tired of walking up and down the steps with a heavy load of wet clothes under her arm. And I would venture to guess that there were days when she probably craved the supple softness that only a dryer can infuse into low-count cotton sheets. In many ways, she lived what we might call today a green or a zero or low-waste lifestyle. But it wasn't because she knew or cared about global warming or the need to conserve energy. She just didn't have much of a choice. There wasn't room or a hookup in her small house for a dryer, and she wasn't accustomed to one anyway. Perhaps it seemed like a foreign and needless luxury. After all, the fact that she even had a washing machine was quite a step up from the hand washing that she'd done for years. When I was younger, I couldn't articulate how much I loved her clothesline or the smell of those windblown sheets. But as I grew older and she passed away, and I gradually became an adult with my own dirty laundry, I began to crave a clothesline of my own. When living in Kentucky, my husband surprised me with one of those fancy clotheslines with pulleys which ran from our porch to the neighboring fence. Then when we moved back to Arkansas, he helped build yet another, this one from some scrap wood. And while I no longer had the energy to run underneath the drying bedding, I still loved to watch the endless whipping back and forth of the sheets, that constant rhythm of their movement at turns both peaceful and violent, in the breeze. Green living, of course, has become a trend these days, with all kinds of products being greenwashed in an attempt to sell them. Oddly enough, so-called green living can even be used as a status symbol, with certain products costing multiple times more than their less packaged counterparts. So much of green marketing, though, it seems to me, misses the point. When I feel like I'm being convinced that I need more money to live a less wasteful life, I feel like something has clearly gone awry. Green living, or as I prefer to jokingly call it, grandma-inspired living, it seems to me is generally about frugal decision-making and the practice of slowing down. Such thinking can feel counterintuitive in our fast-paced culture where convenience reigns supreme. For what it's worth, here's what I learned watching my grandmother. What a clothesline lacks in convenience, it makes up for in opportunities for contemplation, a word literally meaning thoughtful observation. Hanging clothes out to dry is a slow process involving the natural world, forcing you to go outside, listen to the birds, the wind in the trees, or maybe just the neighbor's lawnmower. It takes practice to slow down, and it's not about the kind of practice that makes perfect. Sometimes it means you have the time to think about the laughter of your children, but let's be real, sometimes it just means more time to think about that mountain of unpaid bills. In the end, slowing down is about embracing the imperfect nature of just about everything. Don't get me wrong, I do feel it's important to save resources and to teach my children to save resources. But what I love most about the clothesline is that it helps me channel my inner grandma, connecting me to a woman who revealed to me the magic in the mundane. And besides, with my own children now, I am convinced that when children see fabrics blowing in the breeze, it becomes part of their innate being to run under them, laughing. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin-Motz.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 8th of October, 2012. It's the day that Christopher Columbus reached the New World. 1492 on this date, one of the sailors on the Pinta sighted land, an island in the Bahamas. They'd been at sea for 10 weeks from Palos, Spain, the Santa Maria, the Pinta, and the Niña. Columbus thought he had reached East Asia when he sighted Cuba. He thought it was China. When they landed on Hispaniola, he thought it might be Japan. He made 4 expeditions to the New World during his lifetime, and his discovery made Spain the wealthiest, most powerful nation on earth. It's the birthday of John Cooper Powis, born in Derbyshire, England, 1872, novelist and poet, moved to upstate New York in 1930, wrote his masterpieces Weymouth Sands and his autobiography of Glastonbury, romance. John Cooper Powis did not care for modern life so much, never drove a car, never used a typewriter, did not like talking on the telephone. Powis said, "A great modern novel consists of and ought to include just about everything." It's the birthday of the poet Philip Booth, born Hanover, New Hampshire, 1925. Grew up on the coast of Maine, where his ancestors have lived for hundreds and hundreds of years, has his office in the house where five generations of his family lived before him. He said, "Almost all my mother's ancestors, my grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great, and so on, are buried in the cemetery here. In the November of the year, I often go and look at their graves and see their names and the years carved on them. It gives me a very pleasant and not at all morbid sense of the relations, the relationships that one has with a place." It's the birthday of the comic book writer Harvey Pekar, born in Cleveland, 1939. His father was a Talmudic scholar who supported the family working as a grocer. The kid was smart, but he dropped out of community college, got a job as a file clerk at a VA hospital, spent his free time reading books and collecting jazz records, owned about 15,000 at one time. And it was through record collecting that he became friends with the comic book artist Robert Crumb. Pekar complained to Crumb that nobody wrote comic books about real people and their ordinary struggles. And so the two of them set out to do that. They wrote American Splendor. Crumb did the art and Pekar wrote the dialogue. American Splendor, the first ever autobiographical comic book series. First one came out in 1976, published a new issue every summer. Wrote about going to the supermarket and about his co-workers at the office and losing keys and dating girls and getting married, buying a house, going through cancer treatment, and so forth. Harvey Pekar, who said, "I wanted to write literature that pushed people into their lives rather than helping people escape from them." An anthology of his work was published last year as American Splendor, The Life and Times of Harvey Pekar. Here's a poem about Columbus entitled Columbus Sailed the Ocean Blue by Ramon Montaigne. Columbus sailed the ocean blue back in 1492. He sailed across and spotted land, a beach and people on the sand. He called them Indians because he had no idea where he was. India was just a guess. When in doubt, declare success. A poem by Ramon Montaigne, Columbus Sailed the Ocean Blue, used by permission of the poet. Here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses leverage a powerful form of advertising, online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. And by Goddard College, offering low-residency bachelor's and master's of fine arts degrees in creative writing. More at Goddard.edu. Produced by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow for an all-new edition. Have a great Monday.